So our next and last, but definitely not far from least presenter, is going to be Mary Mbaba. Mary Mbaba is a current research assistant in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society at George Mason University, working on a joint collaborative entitled Project Stride with Yale University School of Medicine and Howard University's Department of Psychiatry. Mary received her MPH in 2012 from Emory University. Her research interests are HIV/AIDS, social epidemiology, health disparities, and the design and implementation of robust mixed methodologies for the study of hidden populations. Please help me welcome Mary Mbaba.
Hello everyone, good morning, how are you all doing today? Thank you all for joining us. I know it's early, but thank you for being here and thank you for the opportunity to let my colleagues and me present today. My name is Mary Mbaba. I'm currently a research assistant in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society at George Mason University in Washington, D.C. And today I'll be going over social correlates and also behavioral correlates of HIV, hepatitis B and hepatitis C, and other health conditions of opioid-dependent, justice-involved individuals. I have no financial relationships to disclose. This is just a brief outline of what I'll be speaking to you all about today. We give you an introduction, followed by preliminary results, infectious disease correlates, and a summary, and last but not least, a discussion with future directions. As most of you all know in this room, substance abuse has been and continues to be a major public health concern. Specifically, opioid dependence and abuse affects approximately 2.28 million Americans. This comes with many multifaceted health and social consequences. And when we speak about opioid dependence, like some of our previous speakers have talked about today, we talk about heroin, morphine, and other prescription opioids. Furthermore, within correctional settings, illicit drug use is often the primary reason for incarceration. Back in the 1970s, we saw that a lot of baby boomers born between the years of 1946 and 1964 became dependent on these illicit substances, and for many of them, their continued use leads to many of their health consequences that they face today. The need for services within this population is great. Also, as Dr. Caldwell mentioned before, we saw huge spikes in the number of incarcerated individuals in the United States of America when the war on drugs actually took place in the early 80s. Also, there's a high occurrence of substance use disorders and severe mental illness, chronic medical conditions, and the transmission of communicable diseases like HIV, hepatitis B, and hepatitis C. Now, the CDC reports that chronic conditions are the leading cause of death and disability in the United States. And the relationship between these chronic conditions and mental health is significant. Furthermore, a compounding factor of being involved in the criminal justice system puts those at high risk and high rates of medical and psychiatric conditions. SAMHSA recent statistics show that between 60 to 80% of those individuals who are under supervision, so people who are under probation, parole, or pretrial, experience a substance use related issue. From 2002 to 2009, drug dependence and abuse was 2 to 3 times higher among those probationers and parolees. And in 2010, mental illness and distress was 2 to 3 times higher among the same population. And to make matters worse, communicable and infectious disease prevalence is extremely increased within substance use populations and those who are involved in the criminal justice system. Shared risk factors often lead to co-infection within these groups. These risk factors include, 1, blood-to-blood transmission, so through needle sharing and other sharing of drug paraphernalia, and by 2, unprotected sex. This can happen between high prevalence and low prevalence groups, as we see that within recent years, heroin and other opioid-dependent users have started to adopt non-injection methods like skin popping or snorting their heroin, but the risk still remains high within this population. Now, this background brings me to the parent study, Project Stride. Project Stride takes place right in the District of Columbia at Howard University Hospital. It's a joint collaboration between Yale University, Howard University, and George Mason University, in which we seek opioid-dependent users who are under community supervision, probation, parole, or pretrial. From that bunch of people, we select those who are HIV positive to participate in a randomized controlled trial for 1 year, in which we track their drug abuse outcomes and their HIV outcomes. Right now, it is estimated by the CDC that 3.2% of people living in the district are living with HIV/AIDS. This is one of the highest prevalence, not only in the nation, but also in the world. Injection drug use has accounted for at least 5% of these new HIV diagnoses. Furthermore, CSOSA estimates that 7.5% of pretrial defendants, probationers, and parolees in the district tested positive for opiates from June 2012 to March 2013. Now, the study design that I'll be presenting today is from a research question that I had in mind. That research question was, what are the health impacts and health conditions of opioid-dependent individuals who are under community supervision, and what are the correlates of specifically communicable diseases within this population? Data was collected from March 2012 to April 2013, in which we sampled 283 unique individuals. This was done by field methodologies like street recruitment, passing out of flyers, and also respondent-driven sampling, which is another form of snowball sampling. To be eligible for the study, persons had to be 18 years or older. They had to be opioid dependent, most of them dependent on heroin. They had to be on community supervision, parole, pretrial, or probation, and they also had to have some type of medical insurance. Upon intake and after consent, research and diagnostic interviews were conducted using a CASI, and each participant saw a physician, in which a physician induction form was completed that included all medical history. Lab work was also collected by blood and urine, and the analysis that is presented today is largely descriptive with bivariate associations of chi-square and ANOVA using SPSS. Everything that is significant here today is significant at the P equals 0.5 level. Now, just preliminary demographics of our sample. Out of 283 that we sampled, 261 had complete data points. 99% of them were African American, 85% male, 13% female, and 1% transgender. The mean age across groups was 51 years old. 65% had completed a high school or GED equivalent, 15% were married or remarried, and 14% had stayed in the shelter in the last 30 days. About a quarter of these individuals were currently employed. Now, of my sample, and for analysis, I split people into five different groups. The first group was those people who only experienced physical conditions. The second, people who only experienced psychiatric conditions. The third, people who only experienced infectious disease. The fourth group belonged to those who experienced two or more of these diseases. And the fifth was the group that experienced no morbidity at all. 15% reported no morbidity. 51% reported comorbidity, so that means that they had two or more of these conditions. About 50% belonged in the physical, psychiatric, and infectious disease condition group, but the highest group prevalence was within the psychiatric group at 55%. 16% of all people reported having all three conditions simultaneously. And this chart just examines the prevalence of my population from the lowest to the highest prevalence. To meet the physical conditions, people had to have history of emphysema, cancer, diabetes, asthma, or hypertension. For the psychiatric group, that included people with schizophrenia, depression, or bipolar. And of course, for the communicable diseases, we're looking at HIV, hepatitis B, and hepatitis C. I didn't look at other sexually transmitted infections like chlamydia, gonorrhea, because I found that the prevalence was less than 2% within this population. The highest prevalence lie within those persons who had hepatitis B and hepatitis C at 44.8%. This is great when we look at the general population in which hepatitis B is prevalent at 0.9% and hepatitis C at 0.4%. Following closely behind was the prevalence of depression at 44.1%. This is almost 7 times higher than the general population. And when we look back at HIV, the prevalence within my population was 8.1%. That is extremely high when we look at the general population in the United States at 0.4%, and even when we look at just that prevalence within the District of Columbia at 3.2%. For every medical condition, my sample experienced higher prevalence rates when compared to the general population, except for cancer at 3.5%. Some main findings, females with infectious disease experienced these diseases comorbidly. So there was no one female within my population that only experienced infectious disease. Either she experienced infectious disease and psychiatric conditions or another condition. Those with infectious disease non-comorbid conditions were significantly older, with a mean age of 54 years. Those with chronic physical non-comorbid conditions were significantly more likely to be married, and those with any comorbid conditions were less likely to be married. Now here's the percent of people living with infectious disease by age and gender. And you can see the highest prevalence lies among those men who are aged 50 years and older. Out of everyone with infectious disease, 71% of them were men aged 50 years and older. This compares to their women counterparts over the age of 50 at 8%. The second highest prevalence lies within males who are under the age of 50 at 16%. Now, because the sample does consist of people who are criminally involved in the community supervision arena, I specifically looked at social factors like rates of incarceration and criminal arrests and charges. This graph shows the lifetime criminal arrests and charges by age and gender for individuals who'd had infectious disease. As you can see, women over the age of 50 had the highest number of criminal arrests and charges, and this is followed by their male counterparts at 17.6 mean criminal arrests and charges over the course of a lifetime. Those with infectious disease did have the least mean number of criminal arrests and charges, but they were significantly arrested most for violent crimes. This shows the lifetime years incarcerated by age and gender for individuals with infectious disease. Even though women over the age of 50 had the highest number of criminal arrests and charges, men who were over the age of 50 had the highest number of mean years in which they were incarcerated in their lives, at about 17 years on average. This compares to 6.5 years among women who were the age of 50 and over. And just to add on to that last slide, those with infectious disease had spent significantly more years incarcerated over their lifetimes when compared across groups. This shows the rates of infectious disease by injection drug use status. Injection drug use, both in the last 30 days and ever in life, was significantly correlated with prevalence of infectious disease. As we can see, the chart on the right shows that those with hepatitis B and hepatitis C had injected drugs in the last 30 days at a rate of 45%. And 40% of those with hepatitis B and hepatitis C had ever injected in their life. Among those with HIV, 39% had ever injected in their life, and 44%, surprisingly, had never injected drugs. Just a brief summary, we see that there's very high prevalence of medical and psychiatric conditions among opioid-dependent individuals who are on community supervision. 44% of these people are actually receiving treatment for their medical and psychiatric conditions, and 34% had been in the ER in the last 6 months. So this kind of marks some type of fragmented care within the system. most experience their conditions comorbidly. In fact, 51% of them had two or more conditions simultaneously. The highest prevalence group was those with people who had psychiatric conditions like depression, bipolar, or schizophrenia. Injection drug use, both in the last 30 days and ever in life, was significantly correlated with infectious disease prevalence. Those with infectious disease had spent the most time incarcerated in their lives. Now, comorbid conditions may affect recidivism rates, especially those who are at high risk of involvement within the criminal justice in the criminal justice system. Research shows that parolees with serious psychiatric and substance-related disorders are rearrested faster than those who are not dually diagnosed. Furthermore, there's a huge lack of service coordination with substance abuse treatment and primary medical care that needs to be addressed within the public health sphere. This is especially important because when people go in for substance abuse treatment, they're not necessarily seen by a primary doctor to address their other physical needs like asthma and hypertension. Furthermore, the Affordable Care Act may offer greater health opportunity, but I must mention that everyone in my sample did have medical insurance, yet only 44% of them have received treatment for their condition. In terms of future directions, we need better research to further explore correlates of disease condition, not just at an individual level, but also looking at major social factors like incarceration. Also, there needs to be proper community engagement at various levels in order to most appropriately address these public health concerns, and this needs to be done in a multidisciplinary fashion. There needs to be synergistic coordination between public health spheres and the criminal justice system. This needs to be done holistically so that people are better able to meet their health needs under one roof. I'd like to acknowledge Yale, Howard, and George Mason University for this research today, and our funders, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, NIDA. I'd also like to thank my participants and my coworkers for the collection of the data, and I'll take any questions at the end of this. Thank you all.
Now we can open up questions for our panel. You can address a question to any one of our speakers. And our first speaker is sitting in the audience right there if you have a question for her. Any questions? Yes.
Well, right now I'm in Portland, Oregon, and it was only in July that we passed our naloxone legislation allowing people to get trained. So that means that lay individuals can get trained. That doesn't necessarily mean that all first responders, even police officers, have the training or enough of the actual drug in their, you know, in their cars or wherever it might be. So there are some efforts coming through our health department. We are working on setting up some new training and reaching out to the police department. In St. Louis, actually, they've just started advertising that, like, the head of the police chief, the police chief, is really pushing all of the police to get trained and to carry naloxone in their cars. There are some communities where this has already been, you know, implemented for a number of years, and what they've done is they really changed the community's relationship with the police force. So where people are really used to getting, you know, the lights and sirens behind them, they pull over. Police are starting to report that people pull up behind their cars and start flashing their lights to get their attention because they know that their friend's overdosing in the back seat. And they know that the police officer has naloxone in the car. So, I mean, the health department's a great way to push it, but frankly, to get the training done, the requirements, it depends on the state.
Okay.
But it's really, it's something that's manageable, although I can tell you right now that the people who produce the kits that are distributed with naloxone, there's two kinds. There's an intranasal and then there's an injection. They're on back order for the injection right now. So we've been distributing the intranasal in Oregon, which is more expensive.
Yeah, that's what I see the most of in Ohio is the intranasal.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yes, it's exciting though. It's a good backorder to have.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Hi, have a question for Dr. Simkes.
I'm definitely not a doctor yet. But you can call me that if you want.
So your study looked at drug poisoning mortality with positive toxicological results for morphine, which is a proxy for heroin. People who die of drug poisoning often use more than one substance. Mm-hmm. Alcohol is frequently being used over the period of your study. In the beginning of your study, for example, cocaine was common. Other substances have been used frequently with heroin. Did you look at the other substances that were involved in these fatalities?
Great question. That was actually my primary research question. And because I had data that came in hard copy form, really, it was PDFs and Word document papers, I did all of my data abstraction by hand. So I had to read through every single case, pull the information. Being a graduate student, my time was limited. So I built the database, and I did actually pull all those variables in there and coded them so that the graduate student who continued could gather those variables. I managed to start and get about a year in, but it's a very slow process. And we did look specifically at exact drugs. What was lovely with this tox report compared to some in other states, we had both just presence, positive, negative, and we had concentrations. And concentration isn't always the greatest thing to look at, since we know people have different levels of tolerance, but it was something that was interesting to look at, because you could see actually men and women didn't have much of a difference in the 1 year that I was able to complete, and you know, it is something we're still looking at, which is very exciting.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Any other comments? Yes, sir.
Mary, why was it only insured?
Because we were actually screening people to receive a treatment that was offered by Howard University Hospital. That was buprenorphine or Suboxone treatment. So from that huge sample, like I said, we were looking for those who are HIV positive to receive treatment. So we wanted those who were screened to have medical insurance so that they came.
So that was only people that can pay.
But I mean, if not, you know, we still give them resources.
Any other questions, comments? Anyone wants to share similar studies that they're doing like our presenters here? Challenges? A good joke? Okay, well, thank you so much for coming to the presentations today, and enjoy the rest of the conference. And let's thank our presenters again. Thank you.